and stay in the basement.
You're on television now. What are you going to say about it? What are you doing now?
Right now, we're doing radio, people, and...
Where are we now?
We're in somebody's house.
And what else is this?
It's a radio station, and we're going to broadcast about...
My name is Kevin Van Hentenrick of the Hunter Stone Carving Seminar, and you are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
You are invited to join me upon the Cypress Bow. Music from North Africa, West and Central Asia. First Monday of every month, 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, featuring first-run and repertory films at movie theaters located in Rhinebeck and Saugerties, as well as live music, filmmaker conversations, staged readings, community events, variety shows, magic, comedy, and more. The latest schedules, as well as upcoming pop-up events at the community theater in Catskill, can be found at upstatefilms.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture in Austerlitz, New York. WGXC local business supporters help us continue to be a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement. Thank you, Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture.
90.7 FM.
Accra, Hudson, Catskill.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Tiffany Greenwald Simon reports for Columbia Green Media that Durham is losing its library and the Durham Task Force. The task force runs the reading room and organizes the annual 4th of July parade, Christmas in Durham project, and beautification programs in the Greene County town. Durham Task Force President Linda Sutton reports the group is down from 15 members to one and said, and I quote, "There's a lack of participation. No one is available to help," end quote. The reading room was the only public library in Durham, and it had Wi-Fi computers and equipment and made copies besides books. Sutton would not name a different group she said might take over some of the group's activities. She said, and I quote, "I'm keeping my fingers crossed," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Mid-Hudson News reports that the Ulster County Legislature voted on December 21st to double their room tax from 2% to 4%. A percentage of the tax is based on whether a business offers more than just room and board, such as all-inclusives. The vote was 13 to 8. The tax will double on January 1st, 2024. The entire Hudson Valley and all of New York are in an affordable housing crisis, and hotels, motels, and home rentals are part of a larger discussion on that issue. Legislator Herb Litz complained that the deal to pass the tax was made behind closed doors. Litz said, and I quote, "The county executive put in her budget to the occupancy tax before the legislature voted to increase the property tax. That's a practice that is backwards, putting the cart ahead of the horse. I don't know why we would ever put something in the budget that we have not passed an increase," end quote. Now, though, the new tax is both in the budget and passed by the legislature. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Liz Montgomery reports for Porcupine Sioux that Daniel P. Mahoney of Freehold, Zachary A. Wood of Preston Hollow, and Eric J. Randillo of New Baltimore were among 232 new state troopers graduating December 21st from the 213th session of the Basic School of the New York State Police Academy. They report for field duty on December 27th. For their first 10 weeks, they will be evaluated under a field training program supervised by senior field training officers. With the new class, the state police now number 4,781 officers. And you can read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice holiday weekend.
Biden's abandonment of Palestinians and Palestinian Americans in Gaza. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Following Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, the U.S. government rushed to evacuate its citizens from Israel. Flights to Europe were chartered from Tel Aviv. A Royal Caribbean cruise ship, the Rhapsody of the Seas, was chartered, taking 2,500 people from Haifa to Cyprus. U.S. citizens, green card holders, their family members, and others in the Gaza Strip, though, weren't so lucky. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in northern Gaza heeded the warning of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to flee to southern Gaza, only to learn that Israel was bombing there as well. No place is safe in Gaza for the 2.3 million Palestinians trapped there.
My mother is an old lady who was living safely in her home. She was displaced many times. Every time they move to another house. They are threatened to bomb that. The Israeli forces are threatening them to bomb the house.
Narman Abushaban, a Palestinian American in Detroit, explained on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
She's paralyzed. She's on medications. And due to the air forces threatening them to displace many times, they were in the north. They had to go to the south. Even when they were in the south, in Khan Yunis, they were threatened in the middle of the night to leave their house. They had to displace her again until they reached to Rafah. And there, her health was getting worse and worse. Until she didn't have the right medication. Due to the Israeli forces, they prevented the medical supplies to get into Gaza. So she had to switch to another medication that did not help her at all. And she passed away, Allah yarhamha.
Rather than a Royal Caribbean cruise ship, Narman Abushaban's mother got a hole in the ground. Abushaban still has 20 family members trapped in Gaza, who she's been unable to reach.
My clients' family members need immediate evacuation from Gaza to reunite with their families and to escape near certain death due to Israel's brutal war on Palestine.
Narman's attorney, Sophia Akbar, said on Democracy Now!,
"We need the U.S. government to create immigration pathways for Palestinians to come to the U.S., to escape deadly and inhumane conditions."
Journalist Fadi Abushamala works as the outreach associate in Gaza for the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Just Vision. He applied for a J-1 exchange visitor visa for a fellowship in the U.S. In November, Fadi was able to cross into Egypt from Gaza, but his wife and three children were prevented. What followed were weeks of hell while they moved from camp to camp for displaced Palestinians in Gaza.
On December 6th, while I don't have connection with my wife and my kids, I get I knew that from the news that the Israeli commission bombed in a Shabura refugee camp, exactly where is my family are evacuating.
That he said on Democracy Now! From Cairo.
For 2 hours and a half, I was waiting any sign that my family are alive. I had to go through the news of WhatsApp thread to look for my kids' photo. I had to look into the photos of the killed children because I knew that there's 20 women and kids were killed in this bombing. I had to open the photos and zoom in to determine if one of these photos is one of my kids.
Sophia Akbar sees disparities in the treatment of Palestinians and other asylum seekers.
Under the Uniting for Ukraine program, all requirements of having connections to green card holders and U.S. citizens were waived. So Ukraine, over 270,000 Ukrainians were allowed to come to the United States under this program. And as advocates on the ground right now, serving, you know, our clients who have families in Gaza, we cannot even get U.S. citizens out. Our advocates had to sue the Biden administration just to get U.S. citizens evacuated.
In a note to Democracy Now!, Reverend Seth Caperdale of Interfaith Rise, a New Jersey refugee agency, wrote, "When a conflict arises in the world, we'll be asked by the federal government to receive an influx of refugees. Kabul fell. Hundreds came here to our agency. The war between Ukraine and Russia started. 800 Ukrainians entered our program. We've received 1,500-plus Haitians. The earthquake in Turkey, immediately we saw an influx of dozens of Syrian refugee families. So why no Palestinian refugees?" he asked. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois and Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Seattle were joined by 100 colleagues urging President Biden to expand TPS, temporary protected status, for Palestinians already in the U.S. to prevent their potential deportation back to the killing fields of Gaza or to Israeli military and settler violence in the West Bank. Israel's killed over 20,000 Palestinians in Gaza since October 7th. 8,000 of them children. This indiscriminate bombing, as President Biden called it, has to stop now. Biden has the power to end it with a simple Christmas phone call to Netanyahu. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And now, here is your WGXE Weekend Weather Report. On Christmas Eve, there will be a slight chance of rain and snow showers before 9 a.m., then a slight chance of rain showers. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature high near 42 degrees and a south wind at around 6 miles per hour. And on Sunday night, it will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 34 degrees. And on Christmas Day, Monday, it will be partly sunny with a temperature high near 47 degrees. And on Monday night, it will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 37 degrees. And that is your weekend weather report from WGXE. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia Counties.
I'm joined by Pamela McCall, author of Twas the Night, The Art and History of the Classic Poems. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So this is the 200th anniversary of what is arguably one of the most famous poems, which was published here in Troy. For many, it brings a lot of memories up of childhood. So why don't we go down memory lane a little bit with you and find out your first experience, what it conjures.
I was given a copy of the poem when I was around the age of four. Whenever Christmas comes around, it's always, as you said, a very nostalgic time of the year. And my family, as many other families, gathered to read this poem on Christmas Eve. You know, I think that that's one of the reasons it survived, is that it was read by a loved one to a child. And it's this memory of that. And then, of course, during this very magical time of the year. So I think that's really the legacy of it. And you know, it's a tradition that's been carried on for centuries now.
Do you have a favorite version of the story or like a copy with illustrations that you recall from your childhood?
Yes, I do. I mean, the one I had when I was four, I still have. It's got a floss cover. It's a die cut. It's, you know, my favorite because my father gave it to me. But I also have editions like Darley edition, which is probably my favorite if you want to come at it from an illustration point of view, because Darley, who was the father of American illustration, does this wonderful illustrated edition of the poem in 1862. And he portrays Santa Claus, Saint Nick, as an elf character, a very tiny little guy. And I just think because he kept so close to the script, the story, it's hard to choose just one. I mean, if one was to ask what is the quintessential Twas, it would probably be maybe Darley, maybe Jesse Wilcox Smith.
Why don't we talk about the author and who he was and what was his story?
Clemency Moore was based in Chelsea. He's a very wealthy family, the Moore and the Clark family out of Chelsea. And he went to Columbia University. He also wrote the first Hebrew lexicon, first Hebrew dictionary in America. He was a real scholar, very charitable man. He also was a loving father. He had nine children. He was a humble man, somewhat eccentric, but absolutely a loving father. And when he wrote this poem, it was intended for his children. And the fact that it was published in Troy was unbeknownst to him, because he hadn't written it to be published. He'd written it for his children.
So what inspired your interest in the topic?
Yeah, it was just a love, you know, a love of history and art and Christmas. And of course, this poem, and I brought it all together. And somebody said to me, you know, how did you write 264 pages on a poem? Well, I mean, this is the period of Moore's life, which is 1779 to 1863. So we're talking, you know, the American Revolution, the American Civil War, and then, of course, into the 1900s and the 20th century. So, you know, it's a pretty big piece of history, and it's pretty fascinating. But you also have to reach back to the 3rd century and the Roman Empire and St. Nicholas to really get the full scope of the story. And then you have to draw all the threads from the Roman Empire through Western culture into America. So it's quite a task to do that and to keep it all coherent. So when Kirkus gave me a review and they commented that it was well organized, that was probably the best compliment I could have got at times, thinking that I was writing the history of the world. So
where did the research take you? Where were the archives that you visited or accessed remotely?
Yeah, well, the Moore papers are with Columbia, so I actually went to the archives at Columbia and read his diaries and looked through all his mother's letters and did all of that, and that was really interesting. It's very intimate, sort of reading somebody's, you know, diary. And I also found the only photograph of Moore in the Columbia archives, which was really fun to find. And that was a really thrilling day when I opened the file and got to see what he looked like. I know there's 6 portraits of the man, but there's something about a photograph. And that was pretty magical. And I went to Cornell and all over the place. But I did a lot of work on the illustrations, too. And so that took me to the William and Mary, the Swen Library, took me to Oklahoma, took me to Westchester. took me to all over the place looking up editions because I wanted to see them. And then, of course, it was just a lot of purchasing because, again, of COVID, I ended up buying a lot of things just so I could see them, and a lot of newspapers and magazines, and then coordinating with other people who are interested in this topic. And there's a lot of literary sleuths out there. So
you yourself are telling a really fascinating story about the poem and how it kind of moves beyond this innocence and nostalgic quality. What were some of the stories that you uncovered about how it was used historically?
You know, I think one of the really interesting things about this poem is that it was written by a man who was, you know, very religious, very, very Christian. And he decided to base it on the story of St. Nicholas, which is the story of Nicholas coming to a family who were in dire straits. The man had two children who were on the brink of being sold into slavery. Nicholas comes and he throws gold through the window and he saves one of them. And then he comes back the next night and the father stays up to see who it is. And he catches him and he says, "Oh, it's you." And he says, "Oh no, I didn't want, this is anonymous. I don't want any gratitude. You want it to be of God." It's so similar to this story. And it's about anonymous giving. It's about generosity. It's about recognizing need. It's about love and charity and all these things. The great thing about this poem, and I think why it survived 200 years, is Moore took out the birchen rod. There is no threat of punishment. And it specifically says there's nothing to dread. It's a very Christian concept with the idea of non-judgment. And I think that that is the quality of this poem that is wonderful for children, because I think that they must have been very relieved that St. Nick was coming without a stick to swat them on the backside with, right? So I really do. So because the year before there'd been a poem written with a Santa Claus or St. Nicholas coming in a wagon with one reindeer and a bunch of books to give to children, but he brought the birchen rod. So I think that that's the quality of the poem. And I think that's the heart of it, is this generosity and this wonderful character of Santa Claus, St. Nicholas, or St. Nick, or an elf, however you want to see him. I mean, another thing that's really interesting about this is that it wasn't illustrated at the beginning. It was illustrated in 1830 by Myron King, but it was presented without illustration. And so you could have an illustrator come to this and interpret it the way they wanted to. And so you can get these great variations on what this Santa Claus looks like. So I think that's really interesting, too. And it works without illustration. And the language of the poem, that he's an elf, I think is important because it does cross into the secular as well. So you can have him, you know, Santa Claus, the elf, can be, you know, enjoyed by many different cultures. I mean, it's been translated into Yiddish because he's an elf. He's pretty well welcome wherever we go. But no, I think that's really, those are the two big things, I think, that would answer the question of why has this poem survived? Why are we still reading it in the 21st century?
Has the poem been used in any way politically or for social causes?
Yes, it has. It was used during the Civil War. I mean, the Civil War, both sides politicized it. They wrote incredible prefaces. You know, like they'd say, "Oh, those damn Yankees, they blocked the roads and Santa Claus won't be coming. The children won't be getting any toys this year, those damn Yankees." And then, of course, on the other side, you know, they'd be doing the same thing. And then you have Thomas Nast, of course, coming to it, illustrating Santa Claus in the camps for Harper's, right? There's Santa Claus giving out presents. Well, there's somebody hanging from a noose on a tree close by in the illustration, right? So it was politicized for sure. I think the Civil War period in my book is probably the most fascinating chapter because it was so interesting what they did with it.
So you're here in Troy with your tome. What do you have planned for your visit here?
Well, I actually arrive in Troy tomorrow morning. And I'm here for a week. I have some speaking engagements in other locations around. And then I'm back again. So the really big things going on in Troy would be at the Waterford Museum. I'm speaking on the 28th and the 29th at the Green Show with Hart Clewitt. We're having a reception with an art installation that I've been involved with Ed Wheeler from Philadelphia, which I'm actually in a U-Haul right now driving to Troy. So I just drove from Philadelphia. That's happening. And then on the 3rd is the big Troy stroll celebration of Twas. And then on the 7th, we're having a Orville Holly award ceremony dinner. And then on December the 2nd, I'm speaking at the Troy Library. And then on December the 23rd, we're all gathered at the library for a community lunch. And we're going to toast the poem on its actual 200th birthday. that's a community event free to the public. And I think that'll be really wonderful. It's a busy time of the year, but I think we'll have people come to that. I hope we do, and say happy birthday. And we'll do a Zoom call so people can call in too. On December the 19th, we're holding a party in New York for Clement C. Moore, because I nominated him into the New York State Libraries Hall of Fame, and they accepted my nomination. And so we've put together a party for 300 people at the General Theological Seminary. I mean, I've got 100 events in 50 days. You know, I'm really looking forward to being in Troy. I really like Troy. I've been there 5 times, I guess. And I was at the Harcluet last Christmas, and I just really enjoy it. It's just a wonderful community. I should also add, I'm speaking at the Emma Willard as well.
Well, we're happy to welcome you back. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
This has been Carolyn Tennant reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Who's got a beard that's long and white?
Santa's got a beard that's long and white.
Who comes round on special night?
Santa comes round on special night.
Special night, beard that's white.
Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus.
Who wears boots and suit of red?
Santa wears boots and suit of red.
Who wears a long cap on his head?
Santa wears a long cap on his head.
Cap on his head, suit of red. Special night, beard that's white.
Big red cherry nose. Santa's
got a big red cherry nose. Who laughs this way? Ho ho ho.
Santa laughs this way. Ho ho ho.
Ho ho ho. Cherry nose. Cap on head. Suit that's red. Special night. Beard that's white.
Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Must be Santa. Santa Claus.
Was the night before Christmas, and all through the
hold Paris... it now, wait, hold it, that's played out. Hit it.
Don't you give me all that jive about things you wrote before I was alive, cause this ain't 1823, ain't even 1970. Now I'm the guy named Curtis Blow, and Christmas is one thing I know, so every year just about this time I celebrate it with a rhyme. Gonna shake it, gonna bake it, gonna make it good. Gonna rock, shock, rock it through your neighborhood. Gonna ring it, gonna sing it till it's understood. My rapping about to happen like a knee you been slapping, or a toe you been tapping on a hunk of wood. Bought a red suited dude with a friendly attitude and a sleigh full of goodies for the people on the block. Got a long white beard, maybe looks kinda weird, and if you ever see him, he can give you quite a shot.